Hello again, everybody. Welcome to the Mainland Podcast. I am Michael Citro, and this is episode 12. And, of course, we represent the mainland.com, SB Nation's Orlando City SC website. Joining me, the ubiquitous Andrew Marcinko. Andrew, how is it going tonight?
Michael, it's going well. How are you?
Going really well. We have a good show tonight. We've got some good guests. And
yeah, we do.
Really excited about this, and we've got a couple of games to cover. We didn't have a podcast last week. That's my fault because I got sick, and I was not up to doing the podcast last week. But we're going to double it up this week and give you twice the guests that we normally give you.
Michael, so. Michael's the only one that knows the technology, so if he's done, the whole process just goes to crap. I'm just the on-air talent. That's all I do.
That's right. Well, you know, sometimes you just gotta know your role,
right?
And you know, my role is just the behind the scenes crap, and you guys are the face of the organization. So there you go, Andrew. So let's start off by talking about Toronto FC. We really don't want to talk about it so much, but we kind of have to because we haven't done that yet. Orlando, once again, a dominating percentage of possession. As they had in previous games. But this time out, not the dominating performance that we've seen in the past. The Toronto game was largely a matter of Toronto parking 9 or 10 guys behind the ball, letting Orlando sort of fall into their traps, and then counterattacking with Jozy Altidore, and they got a couple of goals and put the thing away. What were your impressions overall of the team's performance?
Well, you're killing me here, Michael, because it's been just long enough I've started to forget that performance, and now we're rehashing it again. Obviously, it was tough and a couple tough weeks there for Orlando City with the losses. And I think you said it. Toronto was content to keep 9 men behind the ball for a lot of that game, which might have been a little surprising, but they were on the road, so shouldn't have been a complete shock. And then more or less, Jozy Altidore just outskilled one-on-one. Unfortunately, it was Seb Hines who sort of got victimized both times, but he was just better on offense than the guy trying to guard him was on defense. And, you know, that's why Toronto pays the big money for a guy like Jozy Altidore. And frankly, I bet there are a few Orlando City fans that wish we had a striker like that so far this season as well.
Yeah, and, you know, that's a perfect example. Toronto just showed us a perfect example of what a veteran striker is capable of. Now, Orlando City's been forced to go to Plan B with their veteran, Martin Patterson, on the shelf with a hamstring injury. So they've been having to use young guys that were supposed to come in and learn from Martin Patterson and even, you know, a more experienced guy like Pedro Ribeiro, who's also hurt. But Jozy got the better of Seb. Not completely Seb's fault because he was put in a bad spot by the first goal, he was put in a bad spot by a couple of teammates. And the second goal, put in a bad spot by an incredible long ball that fell perfectly. So it's tough to fault number three on Orlando City, but he's the guy showing up in the highlight film.
Yeah, well, Jozy, you know, world-class players do that too. And yeah, you know, Jozy had a rough go in the EPL, but he's still a world-class player. I don't know if people would seen yesterday with was it Boateng and Messi. I don't know if you've seen that highlight yet, but it was like an and-one mixtape crossover on Messi's move to the goal and just left him. I think the hashtag was rest in peace Boateng or something on the on Twitter. So, you know, world-class players tend to do that to defenders once in a while.
They do. And so the first goal, obviously, the quick restart should not have been a surprise. Toronto had already done one earlier in the game and almost scored on it. They go quick. Amobi Okugo, who's a veteran player and a very good player, was stepping past Jozy out the door to say something to the referee. And Jozy puts the ball down, passes off to Jovinko, gets it back, takes a couple of dribbles. Darwin Serén had a chance to foul him outside the box and take a yellow and passed it up. And then he beats Seb and gets the goal. Darwin maybe could have done a little more there. Darwin did get a yellow later in the game, but in that particular instance, maybe a yellow was warranted to protect a back line. Someone's played soccer yourself. What are your thoughts on taking that intentional tactical foul there?
Yeah, I mean, I think I wrote this after the game as well. There was a lot of blame to go around in that goal, and that was where Seb really got put in a bad place. And I think Amobi would be the first one to tell you that he needed to do better to stop that quick kick. That's a pretty straightforward, you know, move in soccer. You stand over the ball on those free kicks, to give your defense time to get set, and he didn't do that effectively on that case, and I think he'd probably agree with that. And then, yeah, I also, looking at Saren, that might have been one of those times where you recognize the danger and take that, you know, professional foul. Yeah, probably would have got a yellow, but in retrospect, a yellow would have been a lot better than a gold there. So a lot of blame to go around on that one. Seb got put in a really bad place one-on-one, and obviously Oklahoma City paid for it.
Yep, and so they get the one goal lead, and they're already parking the bus a little bit. It made things a little bit tougher. Adrian Heath went to the bench to try to get some offense. First time we've seen all three designated players on the field at the same time for Orlando City. Rochez came on and Rivas came on, and Rochez and Rivas each had a really good scoring chance late in that game, and both horribly scuffed their chance. So that was a little bit disappointing, but they, again, are young players. They're pressing. By that time it was 2-0, and it's hard to fault them. So let's turn our attention a little bit towards the friendly Saturday night. A lot of people didn't see it. It was only televised locally. It wasn't streamed at all. Ponte Preta is a Serie A team in Brazil, top flight. They just got promoted last year for finishing second in Serie B. They came in and they got the first goal on a set piece, and they took the 1-0 lead, and then, as luck would have it, they got a penalty kick. Earl Edwards Jr., a little indecisive coming out of goal, maybe a little bit of a soft penalty. The player certainly was looking for the contact, dragged his leg, but the ref from his position had to call that. And then Edwards made up for it by stopping the penalty, and it seemed to spark the team, and even sparking the team even more was Brian Rochez's header goal off a corner at the death of the first half. So it was 1-1 going to the second half. Orlando City actually took a lead in the second half on another corner. Luke Bowden crossing it in, and Sean St. Ledger getting on the end of that, making it 2-1. Another set piece gave made the game level just about 4 minutes after that. Renato Kaja from Ponte Preta with a really, really nice free kick, well taken. Yeah. And then late in the game, ball goes forward. Kyle Larin gets on his horse, outraces the defense, forces Pablo to take a foul in the box. And then Larin steps up, buries the penalty, and it was basically the last play of the game, and Orlando City wins it 3-2. What were your – you got a little bit different vantage point for that game because you actually watched it in the stands. What were your thoughts on that game?
Yeah, and I had a beer or two as well, so my thoughts are even more colorful on it. It was nice to be take a little break from the press duties every other week. But, great match. I think this was sort of the excitement that Orlando fans have been hoping, praying, wishing for the first eight matches of the MLS season. There were goals, there was tie, back and forth, lead changes. I think everyone's wondering where those three home goals have been in all the MLS games. But one of my big takeaways was the two set-piece goals from the corner kicks. I think one was in a Avila corner kick, and then Luke Bowden in the second half to St. Ledger. I don't think we've scored, well, I guess Kaká's free kick set-piece, but we haven't scored off a header off a corner set piece like that this season, I don't believe. And that's something that's been missing from our game. Obviously, the goal scoring has been missing to some extent in total. But with guys like Seb Hines and Aurelien Collins who've been on the field all season, and Kyle Larin's a big boy up top, Rex Shea's tall as well, you really would have thought we would have scored or at least contested a few more corners yet. So it was exciting and interesting to see them get a few of those in the net. And I hope that that carries over here into the next few MLS games.
Yeah, the free headers have been there on the corners, but we haven't put them in. Akugo's missed wide, I think, four times this year, and Collins put a few over the bar. I tell you, Avila and Bowden both put in balls that you couldn't help but put them in the net. They really whipped those balls in there.
Yeah.
They were really well-taken corners, and I'm not saying they're maybe should be taking them instead of Kaká, but Kaká gives you another pretty tall dude to put in the box as well. So if you have Bowden taking him and Kaká in the middle, it gives you an extra chance to score on those set pieces. The other two main talking points for that friendly win, obviously the Kevin Molino injury. You hate to see that. You never, ever want to see a player get hurt, especially in a friendly. and the play of Breck Shea, the other big talking point. We'll get to that in a minute. First, let's talk about Molino. A lot of people coming out saying, oh, it was a stupid friendly. We should have never had a midseason friendly. This was dumb. And Kevin Molino's hurt now. But Adrian Heath pointed out correctly, you got to have games like this to teach your young team to play together. And it's not like Orlando City didn't have in-season friendlies when they were in USL. Injuries can happen anytime. It's unfortunate. Kevin Molino got hurt. What's your take on that whole situation about having a friendly in the middle of the season?
Yeah, I mean, it's what teams do. Every team in MLS has friendlies. Most teams around the world have friendlies. There are actually more different league games in some of the European leagues, whether it's in England, the FA Cup, or you know, Europa, or Champions League, or all these different things. So teams play a lot of games. It happens. I'm surprised we haven't heard more outcry from the turf people yet. I haven't really heard too many people upset about that. And normally, when you see injuries on turf, you get the vocal crowd of people that say, "Oh, you shouldn't be playing soccer on turf." You can never really say for sure whether it was a cause of it or not. But really, I think there's a lot of people have said it's just an unfortunate aspect of the game. It's unavoidable, and we just hope that he can come back stronger next season.
Yeah, and you know, there was a very vocal minority of people who think that because Kevin Molino wasn't scoring goals, that he wasn't playing well. And you know, if you saw the way he was linking up with Kaká, the way he set up Kyle Larin's goal, you can't really say that Kevin Molino wasn't contributing to the club. He actually was one of the better players on the pitch most of the games that he played. So it is a tough loss. Kaká's preferred attack partner is now out, which leads us to what is Orlando City going to do, and it looks like we're moving Breck Shea up to left wing, and Luke Bowden will play the left back position, which is kind of dicey because your two left backs are on the field at the same time. Mm-hmm. You can't afford to have one of them go down or get a red card. And if you saw the way Breck Shea played in that friendly, it's got to make you feel pretty good. He was basically all over the place and a threat everywhere on the pitch, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, he played well, and you can't really hate this move. It's one of those things where I guess the proof will be in the pudding, so to speak. If he plays really well, if we score some goals with him in there, it'll look like a genius move. Something I've been sort of meaning to write about and thinking is the one person that this move doesn't make any sense for to me is Breck Shea. He's all of a sudden found his way back into the national team starting picture. As far as I can tell, he's the starting left back on the U.S. national team right now, and was likely to start there. It's been a renaissance in his career, which sort of sputtered over the last year and a half in England when he really didn't play any position for anyone for long periods of time. Mm-hmm. To me, he seems to have an incredibly bright future at left back. So I'm not sure I can speak to whether it's the right move for Orlando City as a team right now or not. But my question is, if I were Breck Shea, I would be insisting to stay at left back because that seems like where his brightest future is as a player.
Well, I think Breck, he certainly said all the right things. He certainly said that he would play, he'd play goalkeeper if that's where Adrian Heath wanted to play him. He's shown that he can do that, obviously, this year.
Right.
With a save of the week.
Yeah, sure.
The thing about Breck is I think he really honestly would probably rather be in an attacking role,
yeah,
but
I agree.
He's fine either way. In fact, Soccer by Ives has their quarter of the season All-MLS club come out today, and Breck Shea was their All-MLS left back. So
right.
That tells you how well that people are perceiving him as having played, and he has played very well. But the vocal longtime Lions fans are going to get their wish to see Luke Bowden play regularly, and, you know, There's some concern, at least I have some concern, that maybe he was on the bench for a reason. And maybe part of that reason was that Breck Shea was playing very well in that spot. But maybe part of the reason is pace. I mean, he certainly did get a little bit abused by Dominic Aduro, but Aduro's got uncommon speed.
Mm-hmm.
This New England team coming up on Friday has a wealth of attacking players that can attack you in a number of ways. So he's going to be put to the test right away, isn't he?
Yes. Yeah, there couldn't be a worse team to square off against in your first match, or I guess second match starting as left back. His second ever appearance, I think, in MLS, if I'm recalling that stat correctly. So couldn't be a worse team. He's going to be, he's going to have Teal Bunbury on his side, who's sort of a converted striker. He has some caps with the U.S. national team. Big guy, more of a striker than a winger, so he's going to go at you physically. Almost has a target striker build. He'll also be dealing with Charlie Davies up top, who, again, U.S. national team caps, and Louis Lee Nguyen, whose name I can't pronounce right now, playing their sort of number 10 role, again, U.S. national caps. And then Juan Agudelo is on the other side. So four guys who've all been capped by the U.S. national team, all young, all very, very good. Not going to be a pleasant experience for anyone trying to be on the back line there. And that's the reason. I mean, New England is the hottest team in MLS right now, you could argue. Mm-hmm. Haven't lost in their last seven matches. So going to be a tough match for everyone involved, but particularly Luke Bowden and the rest of the back line.
And they'll have Jermaine Jones bombing forward from the deep midfield position as well. So he's kind of got free rein to get forward whenever he wants. So they do pose a lot of problems. The both of their fullbacks are very good at getting up the sides and putting in excellent crosses. It's going to be a big test for Orlando City. And we're going to talk more about that with our first guest. We'll bring him on in a second. Just to sort of wrap this up, though, we will get Rafael Ramos back in the lineup for MLS. He sat out the Toronto game, which may have contributed to Orlando sort of playing into Toronto's hands and going up the middle rather than using the width of the field.
Right.
Turner, early in the game, Tyler Turner had some really bad crosses. And after that, Toronto noticeably locked down Kevin Molino and left Tyler Turner to his own devices out there. So I think that was a key in that match as well. But we will have Ramos back, and he'll be bombing up the right side. His problem for Ramos now, he's got to get used to playing with a new attack partner down the right as well. So it'll be interesting. But without further ado, let's start bringing in our guests, our cavalcade of stars, and get this party amped up even more. All right, our first guest tonight on the Mainland Podcast, well, it might not be night when you listen to it. I don't know why I said that. This is not a live show. Is Steve Storr. He's the managing editor from the Bent Musket. Steve, thanks for being on the Mainland Podcast with us.
Thanks for having me.
So the first thing I want to find out is, you know, are you guys just like recreating the U.S. men's national team up there? Is that what the plan is? Because you got all these guys that are capped, plus you got this. Now you got a youth international coming in to be a trialist with the club. Is it just going to be like USMNT Northeast?
Well, I feel like that's not necessarily a bad way to go about it. definitely pulling in some talent, but I don't know. I mean, I think it's been a focus of the club to try to build solid and build domestic talent. They've never really been a club that's gone out and splashed on international signings. And, you know, while that was frustrating when they weren't playing well a few years ago, I think it's really starting to work out now. And you get really good team chemistry with the way that they've been doing things.
So they don't have their own Kaká, is what you're saying.
Yeah, you're not likely to see that happening in New England, getting Kaká in here, although I'm sure the Brazilians up here would go crazy if that did. But it's Jermaine Jones was kind of like the Kaká of the New England philosophy, I guess you could say, because he is, you know, he's the big American kind of DP that we have in here, but he's still a U.S. national team player. He's an American player. He kind of fits that ethos and really drives the team forward that way. But yeah, it's kind of cool. I mean, even I don't know if you were going to touch on this, but Will Packwood is even from Concord, Massachusetts. I don't know if there's another, and he's not obviously hasn't signed with the team, and there's no guarantee that he will. But he is coming in on trial. It's been confirmed by the club. He's coming in next week.
Oh, cool.
So it's not only are they building an American team, they're building a very, very New England heavy team, which I think is in this league, the potential for that in this league is vast, and not many clubs have taken advantage. And I like the fact that the Rebs are doing that.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you about Packwood. I saw the story on your trial. He's a good player who just didn't get his contract renewed by, gosh, who was he with out there in England again?
Sorry, can you repeat that?
Who is Packwood with out there in England? It slipped my mind which club he was with.
He was with Birmingham City.
Okay, yeah, and just didn't have his contract renewed there, so apparently coming to trial with the New England.
He, from what I've been able to understand just from reading around some of the stories that have been swirling his recent travails, he was basically sent on loan to Cheltenham Town in the conference premiere and was basically playing for a new contract. Then, in Birmingham since 2007 when he was 14 years old, his father's English, so he was able to just go over and join the academy. And he, played, got some good first team minutes there. He went on loan to a couple teams in League One and League Two. Played well everywhere he's gone. He's just had injuries. Broke his leg pretty gruesomely in 2013. He's had some groin issues. And I guess, there was no guarantee that Birmingham was going to take him back or going to renew his contract. He was probably going to be on a free anyway. So he decided, he went to the club and said, I have this opportunity to possibly play in America, go back home. Can you let me out of my contract early? And the contract was scheduled to end at the end of next month, and they terminated it for him the other day so he could come back, get on trial, and get signed before the May 12th deadline. So given the fact, given the fact that he's due to start training with the team next week, and you could assume this probably Monday, and the window closes end of the day Tuesday, I got to figure the refs have a pretty good idea of what they want to do here because 2 days doesn't sound like much of a trial. But that's just, I'm spitballing on that one, but it kind of makes logical sense,
So let's turn our attention to the guys that are already there. Here's what I've learned from all these U.S. men's national team guys coming back and playing in MLS is that they're going to ruin the USMNT for me because I'm starting to hate some of these guys. Josie Altidore scored 2 goals against us in the last MLS game. Michael Bradley was breaking up everything in the midfield. And I don't want to hate these guys, but I understand from watching Jermaine Jones that he's the kind of guy that if he's on your team, you're going to love him. If he's not on your team, you're going to hate him pretty bad. Tell us a little bit about Jermaine Jones and what he's brought to this team, because the team really picked up a little bit of swag last year when they got him.
You're going to hate him. You're going to absolutely hate him. He's going to be your least favorite player when he's playing against you. That's just the way that he is. What he brought to the team, it was the hallmark of the Revolution teams that had been playing under Jay Heaps were that they were flashy. They had great attacking instincts. They pressed hard. But if you got them down early and you kind of punched them in the mouth, they usually didn't have much of a response. They lacked a little bit of concentration, a little bit of mental toughness. And I don't think that's a commentary necessarily on Jay Heaps as a coach. I think maybe that's more of a commentary on his experience, but it was also a commentary on the youth of the squad. I mean, it's a young team. Jermaine comes in, all this Bundesliga experience, all this big game experience. He's a competitor. He's fiery. He's emotional. So he matches the team in that regard. But he also knows that when you go down early, it's not over, that when you hit adversity, there's ways to overcome it. And that was, I think, the biggest change in the team last year when they went on that giant run at the end and went all the way to MLS Cup Finals, that they would play poorly in the first half or they would go down and it just didn't seem to shake them. Whereas earlier in the season, when they were in that 10-game winless run or in previous seasons, if you got ahead of them early, they rarely came back. They were rarely able to pull themselves out of that hole. And that is, more than his ability on the ball and what he does in midfield, Jermaine bringing that to the team was probably the most crucial thing. Then there's also, of course, the fact that, he's got a tireless engine. He is not afraid of challenges. He's smart. He's a good passer of the ball. He's pretty good in the tackle, and he can finish when he gets the chance. So he's a leader on the field. That's probably the best thing, but he's also, clearly the best midfielder in the team as well. So
If I were Kaká, I would probably watch my ankles if Jermaine Jones is around the ball, because Jones has a history of kind of, he's not afraid to get physical with the other team's stars sometimes, so.
Yeah, no, he's definitely not. Most of the time when I feel like when he gets tackles in that look a little rough, he's just late. I don't think he's a dirty player, per se. I don't think he goes in for the rough challenge for fun, but he is not afraid to mix it up. And if you're a skilled player and you get the better of him, there's a real good chance he's just going to make sure the next time you don't.
Right.
And if that means leaving a little extra in, it might happen. But, look at Kaká. Kaká's been playing with and against players like that for, a decade and a half now. I'm pretty sure he knows what to expect. And, with Jermaine, it's more, Jermaine's, the biggest thing with Jermaine that he does for this team, for the Revs, is what he does when he has the ball. So, the hard tackles, frankly, can come from anybody in the Revs team. But there's no shortage of guys in the Revs team who aren't afraid to come in a little late if they're a little upset about something. So, yeah, Jermaine Jones, Paulo Biancaca, Kaká should probably watch himself a little bit, but I wouldn't only watch Jermaine Jones in that regard.
Okay. Well, talk about to mention a couple of your other attacking threats. Talk about your two wings, your Teal Bunbury and your Juan Agudelo. Both players had sort of played striker when they were younger, but your coach Jay Heath has them moved out to the wings in a supporting role. Talk about how they've adapted to that and what they bring to the New England attack.
Well, with those two, it's two different. It's definitely two different stories. Teal Bunbury is a winger now. I mean, he jumped into that role. He had a rough go of it early last year. Early last season, he wasn't playing well. He was muffing chances left and right. His touch was failing him. He did not play well up top. He got moved up to the wing, and it almost seemed like he decided to take it in steps. He started working on the defensive side of his game, and all of a sudden, he was this incredible, you know, tenacious track-back defender on wing. He still wasn't creating the final product on offense, but what he was bringing to the team on defense with his recovery speed made him, you know, impossible to bench him. And then the offense came, and then obviously in the playoffs, he became a monster. So Teal really has just taken to that role and adapted to the point where he's figured out the spacing. He knows when to stay wide, when to go to the byline, when to cut inside, how to combine. He's, you know, scoring goals now from the wing too, which is, I mean, if he's going to stay this dangerous from out there, you know, you have a situation kind of like Kai Kamara in Kansas City a couple years ago where he's probably the team's most lethal offensive threat, and he's floating in from the outside. It creates a different level of danger that can be difficult for defenses to work with. So Teal really has dove in headfirst, and I wouldn't ever want to mess with him at that position. Juan, I think, is still a better striker. He's still a better number nine. He's still better up front, even as a lone striker or playing off somebody else. His play back to goal is miles ahead of anybody else within this team. And I'm not saying that's not Charlie Davies, just played excellently, but that's just not Charlie's game. Charlie manages to play bigger than himself right now, but he's just not really a target guy. Juan can play that, and he's also skillful enough that he can be a scoring threat and a running threat at the same time. He really is kind of the complete package as a number nine. And playing out on the wing, you highlight the stuff that he loves to do, but I don't know if necessarily you highlight what he's best at. He's adapting, and he's playing well. And I can't take that away from him, but I still think back to 2013 when he was the lone striker. And, yes, he was allowed to combine and drift out with Diego Fernandez and kind of switch positions when it suited him. But he did all of his damage plowing the lone furrow. And, you know, it's no secret that he's doing less damage now. He's not really getting the opportunity to do that. But that doesn't mean he's not dangerous. It doesn't mean he's not good at it. He's playing very well on the wing. He's dangerous. He's still creating combined. Cutting inside, there's a few guys who are better finishers. So, I mean, he's adapting to it, but I think not the same way that Teal did. Teal took it like a fish to water. Juan is having a little bit more trouble, I think.
How have teams tried to defend New England with their, you know, they can hit you so many ways. I mean, they have the strikers. They have the wings coming in. They've got guys that can get up the width of the field and put in some lethal crosses. They got set piece danger. We've now discovered that Tierney has a right foot that he can score with. How are teams sort of setting up to try to defend against the New England attack, and why are they not successful?
Well, I mean, on a day when the attack is clicking completely, you know, and everybody's firing all cylinders and the passing is clean, I mean, teams can kick us, I guess. That's pretty much as good as it's going to get. But in most, what teams have been doing in the past is you try to neutralize Lee Wynn, and you try to cover and close down Chris Tierney. And if you could do those two things, you could effectively destroy any chance the Revs have scoring. Clog up the middle, and anytime Chris Tierney gets down the left, make sure somebody's on him and play overplaying his left foot. That still is not necessarily, you know, a bad idea. Lee Wynn is still the guy, the playmaker, the guy who makes the team tick. He's been playing very well this year, not up to his standards, but, you know, he's still, if you don't pay that kind of attention to him, he will punish you. And now that he's going to have Jermaine Jones coming back in and backing up in midfield again, probably, that's, you know, his game is going to improve, because that's definitely helpful for Lee. And, you know, but Chris used to be the only wide threat. So if you took him away, you couldn't get wide. You could cover Lee. If you take him away, you try to isolate Lee and then clog the middle, because the Revs would just try to play through the middle, and they wouldn't get wide. They wouldn't have any other width. Couldn't figure out how to get around it, and you could basically bog your game down and catch on the break. The real key to that not necessarily being a viable option anymore is then London Woodbury, of all people. He started the last three games at right back, and kind of out of nowhere, he's suddenly become the best right back crossing option the Revs have had in a decade. And he got the assist last week on Charlie Davies' goal. Now all of a sudden you have to respect the right side too, and it comes to a point where you really have to pick your poison. You're going to have to pay more attention to one or the other and hope somebody's having an off day. It's still not a bad idea to clog the middle against the Revs. They're still going to try to create in the middle. They're still going to drift that way. Keel and Juan are both going to pinch inside. Lee's going to press up, and there's going to be four players, including Charlie Davies, in that middle that are going to be, they're going to bunch themselves up. Mm-hmm. But with Jones in the midfield, he'll encourage them to spread it, and with two flank options, it's not going to be as effective anymore.
Would you say the big matchup then of the game would probably be Amobi Okugo against League Win?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. I think that's going to be your Amobi Okugo against League Win and Aurelien Collin against Charlie Davies.
Go ahead. Sorry.
That's Lee being able to pick his passes and create and spring the counter is so key to this team when they're playing at their best. And Charlie has been nearly unplayable for the last 3 weeks. So if Aurelien Collin or if anybody in their Atlanta defense can neutralize him, it's going to be big. It's going to be tough to do.
Well, I have to say, I think London Woodbury is the most British name possible. Like, I don't think you can get
the least British-looking person I've ever met.
Right, totally American. So no connection at all, but it's just truly the most British name of all time. But to give some hope to Orlando fans, because admittedly this matchup doesn't look great. New England's on fire right now and really a talented squad. I've noticed you're not a tall team, though. You have, I think, Andrew Farrell, one of your center backs, is, 5'10", 5'11". The midfielders are short as well. Do you see any danger of some of Orlando's tall players, or Aurelien Collin, getting in and scoring on a set piece at some point?
Yeah. If you're worried about being able to break down the defense or whatever, nicking a goal on a set piece isn't something that you're necessarily going to struggle with. Andrew Farrell has hops, he can jump, but Andrew, a lot of times, the way he plays the game, because he's so aggressive, he'll end up in a position where he's backpedaling and trying to get height that way. And I've seen, Frank Martin's just schooled him from a header perspective against Seattle on the first game of the season. And now Andrew hasn't been beat that bad since, but you've seen it. And that's just Farrell. I mean, there's height in this team. That's the thing, is it's deceptive. You look at Andrew Farrell, and he's been the face of the defense so far, and yeah, he's not that tall. And he can jump, but you don't think of him as great in the air. But his normal defensive partner is Jose Gonçalves. Over 6 feet tall, can jump, great positioning sense, he's very good in the air. Chris Tierney is 6'1", I think he's my height, maybe a little bit taller than me. London Woodbury is taller than I am, I'm 6 feet tall. London Woodbury is probably 6'2". Jermaine Jones in the midfield, about 6 feet tall, or close to it. Andy Dorman playing a lot of time in the midfield, he's about 6'1". Teal Bunbury, Juan Agudelo, these guys are not small, and they can match up with tall players. The Revs can neutralize tall threats. But there are weaknesses there. Some of those tall players aren't natural defenders. They will lose markers on set pieces. And Andrew sometimes will, overplay something, or he'll end up backpedaling or something along those lines. And that's someone like Aurelien Collin, who is just a master in the air, who can score goals that way. It could have some success. It's definitely something that the Revs should be worried about. And if I'm an Orlando fan, I'm thinking that anytime there's a corner or a dangerous free kick, I'm thinking put it at Aurelien Collin's head, because at some point another he'll probably score.
Well, we just saw two goals off corners in the friendly last week, so that's looking like our best option right now, because the team has one goal in four home games in MLS play. And that came on a free kick from Kaká that was deflected by the wall. Nothing in the run of play so far. So, we might have to just get a whole bunch of corners. That might be the thing. But Steve, before we let you get out of here, we've talked a lot about what, we're afraid of with New England. What are New England fans saying about this Orlando team, and what Who are the people they're most concerned with in terms of the game on Friday?
Well, clearly everyone's concerned with Kapow. I mean, you can't count him out. There's even at his advanced, it's not even really that advanced, but you could say advanced age. Even at where he is right now, there are problems. He can go into gears that other players in this league just have never seen before. You know, and he can beat you in so many different ways, even without that game breaking speed that he used to have in his arsenal. And that it's that vision, that technique, that ability on the ball, that, you know, ability to look at a high pressing team that would normally pluck the ball off of a guy's feet at the center line and just say, no, you won't get the ball today, and somehow keep it. You know, Kaká can do that, and that kind of screws with the Revolution game plan of high press, keeping the ball in the opposing half. So everyone's kind of worried about him because he can do everything from here for that team.
I'm gonna tell him you said advanced age, by the way. That's bulletin board material right there. That's gonna get him fired up for the match on Friday.
Well, like I said, it's a kind of advanced, but advanced for a softball player, not even really that old. He's just been so good for so long, and you think that he's old. I would be worried a little bit myself, and this is me personally, if I'm looking at that team, Aurelien Collins. He's a good defender. He tackles hard. He's not afraid to mix it up. And, he's great in the air. And on set pieces, he will punish you if you can get good deliveries, and with Kaká, you're going to get good deliveries. Also, probably looking at that team, Breck Shea. Speed on the left, he'll be attacking he'll be attacking London Woodbury. And London Woodbury is a defender first. He's a convert to center back, so his positioning should be sound. He's not slow, but Breck Shea is fast, Breck Shea has technique, Breck Shea is tall, he's physical, he's got all the tools. It's going to be probably London's first real serious test in terms of the talent he's going to be looking at in front of him. So if you're going to get some love against the Revs in the run of play, you're probably going to get it that way, and I'd be a little worried about it. And this is a lot of team speed for Orlando. And speed can be rough on this team. You know, London has speed, but Chris Tierney's not known for it. So if you're going to try to pin him back and not let him get crosses in, having a fast right winger isn't really a bad idea. And I know Kevin Molino's out, but Orlando has no lack of speed options up top. So that worries me a little bit, too. It can be difficult for the defense sometimes to deal with game-breaking speed, as it can for any defense, but the Revs in particular have struggled in the past. So I'd be worried about Kaká's vision, Kaká's just magic, and also the speed and technique of the wings kind of disrupting the game plan for the Revs.
All right, well, we'll see how it plays out on Friday night. Steve Storr, managing editor of the Bent Musket, our sister blog over on SB Nation. Thanks so much for being with us on the Mainland Podcast.
Thanks for having me, guys. It's a lot of fun.
We got a special guest this week on the Mainland Podcast. Joining us from your Orlando City Lions, it's goalkeeper Earl Edwards Jr. Earl, thanks for being with the podcast.
Yeah, of course. No problem.
So the first thing I want to do is I want to ask you about something that just happened recently because it's fresh in my mind, and I didn't get a chance to talk to you about it after the game. Coaches' press conferences lasted just a little too long, but and you were already probably out looking for a place to see the Pacquiao-Mayweather fight. But I wanted to ask you about the penalty save Saturday night against Pancha Preta, and kind of walk me through what happened and what you thought would happen. Obviously, you picked the right direction, and then maybe a little bit about how it seemed to pick the team up a little bit afterwards.
Penalties in general, it's obviously the keeper's doesn't have the best odds, but I think penalties are something I've seen as a strength of mine. Unfortunately, I was able to make the save and read the guy going to my right. It took a while to get to the ball, and I knew he was kind of waiting for me to go one way or the other, so I held my ground, and luckily, like I said, went the right way. I was able to make the save, and Connor Donovan did a hell of a job coming in and cleaning up the rebound to secure the save. So, it was a big moment for the team. In general, I wished I hadn't given up the PK in the first place, but to make up for it, I definitely think helped us and gave us a little bit of momentum and kept us in the game.
Yeah, well, to be fair, I'd call that a pretty questionable PK call to begin with. I'm sure you've seen the replay. It looked like he had quite a few steps there to try and avoid you. But not to give away any secrets, but I was curious, did you guess to your right from the beginning, or did you see something in his runoff that tipped you off to go that way?
A little bit of both. I felt like he might go to my right, and then his approach, I think, hinted at that as well. So I just stayed with my instinct and just had to get the timing right.
Well, we're real glad you made that stop. It ended up being the difference between a draw and a victory in the end, and it was nice to see the Lions get a home victory in front of the Citrus Bowl faithful. Earl, I wanted to ask you a little bit about the 2015 MLS Super Draft. Most people that are drafted after the first round, it's not a real positive, successful record for making the club. But you not only made the club, but have become like right there behind Donovan Ricketts and a very important part of the club already. What were your thoughts going into draft? Did you kind of think maybe I can catch on in the USL, maybe work my way up if things don't go well with the club? Or did you just enter camp with the mindset that there's no way that I'm not making this club?
Going into the draft, I was pretty open to anything. If a team wanted to sign me and loan me out, I was open to that. If I could sign and stick on with the first team and compete for a number two or number one spot, I was obviously more than happy to do that. But as I ended up at Orlando, things were kind of open. It was an open competition, so I just did my best to put myself in the best position possible. And luckily, I ended up in the situation I am now, playing behind Ricketts and being in the 18 for each game and getting to travel and having that experience as a young keeper is a blessing. And I'm happy I have people like Ricketts and Tally Hall to learn from and continue to push me on a daily basis. And I'm fortunate as a rookie to be in the situation that I'm in.
Yeah, I think it's worth pointing out to people who maybe haven't played a ton of soccer themselves that being a backup keeper is a hard job, because you have to be mentally ready every single match, in and out, right? Even though there's a really good chance you're not going to play, but you never know, and you have to be ready to go in. Could you talk about, you know, what do you do? How do you keep yourself at 100% preparedness just to be ready if anything does happen?
I think, personally for me, the college game helped me with that. So I went into UCLA and sat for my first 2 years behind Brian Rose with Galaxy Now, and I that was a huge learning experience for me. And I've always said, I stayed at UCLA for another 3 years after that. And I've always said to people that ask me about my college experience, is that something that I'll take with me into the future? I know as a rookie and a young goalkeeper, it's going to be hard to be the starting guy right away, nearly impossible, really. So to learn how to be the backup as I did at UCLA, I think that was a huge a learning experience for me, and something that I've carried on to my professional career, and something I've dealt with before in the past. So I'm glad I had that experience, and it's something that I know to deal with, and continuing to apply what I learned there at the professional level.
Earl, I know that with Tally Hall getting ready to come back soon from his injury, things are going to start getting a little bit more crowded in Orlando City Nets. Have there been discussions on what might happen when Tally comes back, and whether there might be a loan opportunity for somebody, whether it would be you or Josh or even Donovan? Have there been those kinds of discussions, and you know, what can you tell us about what might happen when Tally comes back?
Yeah, there hasn't been a ton of open discussion about it. As you know, Tally and Ricketts are two extremely established goalkeepers in the league. So for me, I'm just going to have to keep my head down and keep doing what I'm doing. If it works out that I can remain the number two, that's great. If I get moved down the ranks and have to go on loan or whatever else I have to do, I'm willing to do that too. And my job doesn't change. I keep the same focus, same work ethic, and whatever happens, happens. And To straight answer your question, there hasn't been much discussion about it at all. So it seems that they're keeping it pretty open, and I'm just going to keep doing what I've been doing.
So as far as, you know, playing keeper, you're sort of generally in a leadership role on the team, but obviously you're a pretty young guy. You're a rookie. I think you're 23 now. But you were, for those who don't know, I think you were a captain for your last 3 years at UCLA, if that's correct, you can correct me. But how do you lead the team? How do you lead the guys on the field when you're just a rookie, you know, when you're the young guy? Is that difficult for you?
I wouldn't say difficult. It's just a different way of leadership. So being a young guy, it's not so much vocal and standing out in the sense of, being vocal or telling guys what to do so much, but it's more by example, by work ethic, keeping your head down and just doing what you're supposed to do. And for me as a keeper, obviously I have to be vocal on the field in terms of putting guys in positions they need to be in. And I think that as that comes, guys will trust me more. And as I continue to, like I said, do my job, keep my head down, make saves, and keep the ball to the goal, guys will respect me more and more. But in terms of being a leader, I think it's, at this point, as a young guy, more by example as opposed to the more vocal leader I could be on and off the field at UCLA. It's a different experience.
I mean, does that feel weird when you're in, like, practice and you have to give, like, a defensive command to, like, Breck Shea or somebody or Aurelian Collin, you know, these guys you probably were watching when you were in high school and definitely college and stuff? Is that, like, a weird feeling?
It's not extremely weird for me. I was fortunate enough to be with MOVN, Breck. We overlapped in residency, so I'm very close to those guys, which has made the transition easy. Eric Avila and I played Nomads together growing up, so there's some guys on the team I've known for a long time, and that makes it more comfortable. And fortunately, also at UCLA, my coaches set me up training with multiple different MLS teams throughout my last 2 years of school, and I got comfortable with the environment. So it's not something that's been an extreme jump for me, but it is. I understand what you're saying. It could be a little intimidating. Barking out orders to guys that have played over in England or guys that are established all-stars in the league. But no, it's something I'm comfortable with and I'm enjoying.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned that you knew some of the guys coming in, because that was going to be my next question was going to be, if you thought it helped you get comfortable quicker coming in with a young team with a lot of young guys, and you didn't have quite so many big personalities and veterans on the team like you might have coming on getting drafted by an established team rather than an expansion team. What was it like coming in with a bunch of guys that you're actually older than?
I mean, that was also coming out of, like I said, I was at UCLA 5 years, so I was used to being the old guy. And so in that sense, having a bunch of young guys in the locker room, it's great that we do have a decent amount of veterans. It's a good mix of age throughout the group, and it's nice to have young guys, and it's fun to see them grow and see myself grow along with the older guys. And it's cool to see how we all make it work, having multiple 19-year-olds in the group along with up to Ricketts, who's 37. So it's cool to see how there is no real hierarchy on our team. It's nice to see in the locker room everyone gets along. And it's really a fresh start being an expansion team. So everyone, obviously the older established guys, demand more respect. But it's nice to see that there's no guys that stand out above others and help the young guys along.
So no rookie hazing. You don't have to bring Donovan lunch every day or anything.
nothing to that of that sort.
So I gotta keep it 100 question for you on this one. In practice, mm-hmm. other than Kaká, who has the best shot on the team?
Best shot in terms of consistently finishing, or because if we're going power, Carlos Rivas absolutely destroys the ball. Sometimes it's frustrating as a keeper when a guy's doing that from 7 yards out.
Right.
The pure finisher, and I hope he doesn't hear this because he'll be pretty excited, but when he gets in front of goal, Breck Shea is pretty good.
Okay, good to know.
So, Earl, before we let you go, just one final question. I wanted to ask you what you so far have learned from Donovan Ricketts, a guy with a lot of experience, and what have you learned so far from Tally Hall? What have those guys sort of imparted upon you here early in your career?
I think Ricketts has had a huge influence on me. I was fortunate enough to train with him. I came out of residency and took the winter quarter off at UCLA. I went and trained with Galaxy for the preseason. I was 17 years old when Ricketts was there. Got to train with him again last summer in Portland. So I've known Ricketts going on 6 years now, and we've kept in touch. And since I've gotten here, he's been nothing but a huge help for me. And I think he enjoys having a younger guy he can take under his wing, and he's imparted a lot of wisdom and knowledge of the game for me, and he's willing to help me. So it's great that I can go to him with questions or just things about the game and life, whatever it is. And being an older guy, he's always willing to help. So the biggest thing I think I've taken from him is that no matter what, there's highs and lows throughout the game, so you really got to stay level-headed. And as old as that saying sounds, it's something that he lives, and it's cool to see in person that it's someone that takes that seriously regardless of how well he's playing or if you think he had a terrible game. He's always on the same level, same personality, never too high, never too low. So it's cool to see that up front, especially with the situation I'm in. Young guy, maybe not going to get a lot of playing time. Maybe I will. So keep that level head and that same work ethic is something that he's helping me stay focused on.
Well, before we let you go, we got to get a prediction. You guys have first place New England coming to town Friday night here for your next MLS League match. What do you got? Can the Lions pull off a win this weekend?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think we're capable. We've had some great performances. Unfortunately, we've just struggled to score a bit, but I think our play has spoken for itself, and hopefully we can open things up and get some more goals at home and carry the momentum off of this friendly into this game. Obviously, we respect what New England has done this far, and we won't underestimate them by any means. So it'll be a good one, and we're ready to go.
All right, sounds good. Earl Edwards Jr., Orlando City goalkeeper, thanks so much for being on the Mainland Podcast with us, and we hope to have you on again soon.
Yeah, thanks again. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Well, we're just about ready to put the finishing touches on another magical Mainland Podcast. Really want to thank our guests tonight, Earl Edwards Jr., of course, of our own Orlando City Lions, and Steve Storr from the Bent Musket. Really a good show when you can put some quality guests together like that. And, Andrew, you know, before we get out of here, we always got to do this thing where we talk about the game and talk about what we think is going to happen and predict who's going to win and that kind of thing. And we're inevitably wrong in the worst possible way.
Sure, yeah.
So are we gun-shy yet? Are we going to try to do this again this week?
I mean, I hope maybe eventually I'll get it right. It feels like it's the odds of just luckily getting it right at some point have to happen. But I will contend, and I've said this before, I think Orlando City has been unpredictable. That, I mean, what team is this bad at home and goes out and wins matches on the road consistently, you know? We beat really good teams and lose to bad teams sometimes. It's not so much that our predictions are that awful. I think the team is just totally unpredictable and so far this year. So to give us a little bit of credit, at least.
So it's not us, it's them.
Exactly.
Totally them.
Right. That's what
we're doing what we're supposed to do, and we're doing everything right, and they're screwing it up.
Right. That's what all of my exes have told me. It's not them, it's me. So
awesome. Okay. Well, why don't you go first? I know what I have in mind, and you're probably going to say the same thing, and then I'll look stupid, and or I'll have to change it. But go ahead and tell me what you think is going to happen on Friday night.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough to predict a win here. You want to come out and say the Lions are going to win every match, but there are some where you have to be realistic. And realistically, New England is very, very hot right now, and they're a really good team to begin with. They haven't lost in their last 7 matches. Everyone was pretty much predicting them to win the East to begin the year anyway. Incredible attacking talent, Jermaine Jones running things from the midfield. Just a really great all-around team, probably the best in the East right now and probably will be at the end of the year. So I think we're going to have a hard time beating them. I think they might come into the Citrus Bowl and beat us, you know, 2-0, 2-1, I think.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's kind of hard to argue with it. There's so many things going on with Orlando City right now. You got Molino's injury that they've got to deal with. You've got Breck Shea moving up probably to play the midfield this week for the first time. Bowden's going to be playing left back against a very, very difficult attack. So, it, you know, all signs point to really needing an outstanding effort from the defense and the goalkeeper. And the last couple of home games, or the last two games combined, Orlando City has lost 5-0. I mean, look at Toronto and Columbus. Now, Columbus, obviously, 10-man, so it's kind of hard to deal with that. But, you know, as much pressure as Columbus can put on you, it's nothing compared to what New England's offense can do. So, I mean, it's going to be really, really tough. It's really hard to predict goals for Orlando City or to say they're going to score when they have proven time and time again that they are not scoring at home. But I think maybe they take a little bit of confidence out of that friendly victory and getting three goals in that game. Maybe they scratch for a goal. But I do see this as a loss, and it might be a 2 or 3-1 loss. I think on the Bent Muskets Q&A exchange, I think I optimistically said maybe it's going to be a 1-1 draw, but that's, I think, a little optimistic to think we can hold New England's offense down with a back line featuring somebody that's only playing their second MLS game. And especially since the last couple of games have been a little bit tricky back there. And it's not just the back four responsible for that. I think the communication with the defensive midfield the last two games has not been as good as it had been previously. So maybe they can get that cleaned up. I hope they can, because early on it was working pretty good. But, you know, now they've got several games on tape that people can look at. And, you know, this is a league of adjustments. And, you know, if Orlando City's back line looked really good the first few weeks, maybe other teams are starting to figure them out a little bit. So maybe the next adjustment needs to be made by Orlando City. Hopefully it'll be Friday. But I am not feeling particularly good about this game.
Yeah, well, you know, like I say, with our track record, with all this adversity, everything pointing to a really tough game and probable loss for Leonard City, this will be the game that they come out and miraculously score, you know, 3 or 4 goals at home and something and shock everyone. But if we're trying to make the legitimate predictions here as soccer bloggers, you got to say it doesn't look promising.
Yeah. Now, we're not haters, so don't go there. We're not hating on the team because we're predicting what we think might happen.
Right.
We're just trying to give you our honest assessment as, I don't know, not really experts, but maybe students of the game. Let's call us that.
Sure. That's probably still generous, but I'll take it.
Students are always learning. So
yeah.
That's the thing about students, is that they're not graduates. They're students, and they're still learning. So you know, if we're not quite correct 100%, then so be it. But, I mean, we kind of got to go with our guts here, and that's what our guts are telling us. We're not hating. You know, that's just the way it is. So we'll see what happens Friday night, Andrew, and I'm looking forward to it because, you know, if nothing else, got a lot of world-class players going to be on the Citrus Bowl turf on Friday night. And, of course, you know, they're used to playing in a large football stadium, so it probably won't be a whole lot different for them. But the atmosphere was really, really good last week, especially when Orlando City scored a couple of goals. And so I'm excited. Can't wait to see what happens.
Sure, it should be an exciting match. I think that's a lot of talent on the field, like you say.
All right, so we're going to call it a podcast, folks. That does it for episode 12. We will be back next week to recap all of the action from New England and Orlando City. And we'll look ahead. Who the heck do we have next? I haven't even looked that far ahead. Is it Columbus again?
Gosh, I can't remember either. We should really be on top of this.
Ah, we should. And I know we got the Galaxy coming up too, which is another, that'll be a big game as well. So, but anyway, by the time we record next week, we'll have figured it out. And
one can only hope.
Yeah, so that's it for this edition. On behalf of Andrew Marcinko, editor over here at themainland.com, I am Michael Citro, managing editor, saying go City.